Well, welcome back, everybody. It looks like in the gallery that people are starting to gather and appear. So nice to see you all. Welcome to anybody who maybe has joined during the time while we were sitting. It's nice to be here as we complete our year-long study of the cycle of dependent origination. And in fact, to me, it really feels like I'm completing a cycle because I didn't remember this when I first agreed to substitute for Tim. But then I thought about it, and actually in January, at the very beginning of the year, in the old days, when we were still back at the Friends Center, I substituted for Tweri for our first talk on this cycle and gave an overview. And then here it turns out I'm here again for the last one. So, you know, at the beginning and at the end. And wow, what a year it has been too. Very strange year, a terrible year in many ways. And yet one of the things I do feel good about is that it has been a good year exploring this topic of dependent origination. And I feel like I've learned a lot, and I hope that you have too. It's been a very rich exploration for me. Now, as I mentioned earlier, our subject tonight is transcendental dependent origination, with a particular focus on disenchantment, which was Tim's topic last week. And this is the link that comes in the cycle after we begin to see more clearly and have a sense of what's really going on. And as Tim said last week, when we hear that word disenchantment, at least in English, what usually comes to mind is this sense of feeling disappointed, of feeling disillusioned. And we may think that disenchantment means that we come to this place in our practice where everything we encounter just seems kind of blah. And the ordinary things of our life just don't have any kind of appeal for us anymore. Just sort of, ugh. And I won't say that such feelings never arise, because, you know, sometimes they may or they do as a reaction to what we understand. But I think a more helpful and more accurate way to characterize disenchantment is the way that Tim presented it last week, which is more as being freed from enchantment, as waking up from the enchantments that keep us from seeing clearly and that keep us stuck in this cycle of suffering or this cycle of samsara. And the idea of enchantment can bring to mind lots of different scenarios in our minds. Some of them very specific and very personal ones. Some of them quite general. I think as many scenarios as there are people in the room, and maybe more. But overall, especially looking at it from the practice point of view, I think that many of the different enchantments we fall under can be thought of as belonging to three main categories. First is the enchantment of the pleasant, then the enchantment or the fantasy of the permanent, and finally, the enchantment of the story of me. And these enchantments are also known as distortions of mind. You may have heard of these in some talks or read about them. And they're described in the Anguttara Nikaya. And the presentation there is a slightly different, because what I've called the enchantment of the pleasant in this presentation includes two aspects. One of them is seeing pleasure in suffering, and the other one is seeing the unlovely as lovely. So there are two a little bit different aspects of being caught up in a kind of a delusion about pleasure. And this is what the Buddha says about these distortions of mind. These four, O monks, are distortions of perception, distortions of thought, distortions of view. Sensing no change in the changing, sensing pleasure in suffering, assuming self where there's no self, sensing the unlovely as lovely. Gone astray with wrong views, beings misperceive with distorted minds, bound in the bondage of Mara. Those people are far from safety. They're beings that go on flowing, going again from death to birth. In other words, going round and round in that cycle of samsara. But when in the world of darkness Buddhas arise to make things bright, they present this profound teaching which brings suffering to an end. When those with wisdom have heard this, they recuperate their right mind. They see change in what is changing, suffering where there's suffering, non-self in what is without self. They see the unlovely as such. By this acceptance of right view, they overcome all suffering. So you can see from this description that when we're caught in enchantment and when we're caught in these distortions of mind, in some way or another, we're not seeing the three characteristics of dukkha or suffering, of anicca or impermanence, and anatta or not self, those three characteristics that are such an important part of our Buddhist practice and that we talk about, that we hear about over and over and over again. So when we're under enchantment, we're just really not seeing these things clearly. And so another way of looking at this enchantment and disenchantment is to say that this disenchantment that the transcendental dependent origination speaks about really ties into understanding the Four Noble Truths. And this process of becoming disenchanted is actually our understanding more deeply and more clearly for ourselves the Four Noble Truths. So if transcendental dependent origination seems like a very unfamiliar and strange thing, thinking about it this way might put it into a context that's a little more familiar. So it's kind of waking up from these enchantments that make us think that what's not permanent is permanent. What actually can lead to suffering is really pleasant and will lead to happiness, and makes us think that what really is not personal is all about me and mine. So just going in a little bit more detail into these enchantments, all of which are very familiar, but they're so close and so easy to fall into that I don't think you can ever think or talk about them too much. First, there's this enchantment of the pleasant, that feeling of, oh, if I can just get this thing I want, life will be perfect. That fantasy of how great it will be when our dreams come true. Well, it's so seductive. And I mean, a lot of times, you know, we don't articulate it in this really obvious, oh, if I just get this thing I want, everything will be perfect. But there's sort of this hidden assumption in our minds that makes it seem, wow, even if the dream is only about you know, getting a Hershey bar or something as mundane as that. And not only is the fantasy of the thing seductive, the feeling of the sense of moving toward it is too. And I discovered this for myself in an interesting way. I think I know some of you were at Philip Moffat's retreat earlier this month and did the exercise where we were doing walking meditation, and for part of the time we walked with our attention on what was up ahead. And that experience really surprised me. I was amazed at the feeling of energy that that brought up and the feeling of anticipation. And I wasn't even going towards anything exciting or anything I especially wanted. I was just going toward the fence that was near one end of my walking path. I mean, what's more neutral and blah than that? But somehow that sense of moving toward, of moving closer to a goal, of getting somewhere was just really surprisingly seductive and powerful. And, you know, also tied up with this enchantment of the pleasant and moving toward the pleasant. And along with the enchantment of the pleasant, it's also so easy at the same time to fall prey to the enchantment or the fantasy of permanence and feel that once we get that pleasant thing, well, that's the end. Our happiness is going to last forever. But we don't realize, or to be more accurate, I think we realize, but we forget. We forget and we don't see it because we're so caught up in this pleasant thing, that that pleasant thing is going to eventually end or it's going to change. And when it inevitably does, well, if we're not ready for that, there's going to be suffering. So by seeing this pleasure only and not seeing this potential disappointment when it's over, we suffer. Or sometimes we make this mistake of seeing the unlovely for the lovely. We see only the momentary pleasure of that thing we are pursuing, and then we don't see the possibly very unpleasant consequences that might follow when we actually do get that thing. And I think we all know examples of this. These range the gamut from, you know, that sort of regret and discomfort that we feel when we've had a few too many treats over the holidays, to some really, really serious problems, you know, all the havoc that can come into our lives from drugs or alcohol, or, you know, the disastrous love affairs or out of control spending, you know, things that really can produce terrible, terrible suffering. But in the heat of the moment, all we think about is the pleasure. Now, this fantasy of permanence, it can arise with this idea that the pleasant is never going to go away. And it also can arise, too, in this idea, which is very closely related, that things should always go smoothly. So if something is going well in our life, it ought to stay that way. Nothing should change or get old or get sick or break down. I mean, we know that isn't true. We know that isn't true. But somehow there's this assumption that it should be true. So when something does happen and something does go wrong or change or break down, then we're all upset. Somebody's got to be at fault. Yeah, something to really be angry about. Or maybe the conclusion we draw is that somehow we are at fault and we have something to really be ashamed of. Or this fantasy of permanence can also take the form of a kind of cynical hopelessness where we feel like nothing will ever improve, nothing will ever go right for me. It's always going to be this horrible way. But of all these enchantments, I think maybe the most insidious one and the hardest one to see and the hardest one to wake up from is this enchantment of the story of me. It's just so pervasive, you know, and, you know, part of it is the inaccurate ideas and perceptions we have about ourselves, you know, seeing ourselves as being only a certain way, always angry or always fearful or this or that. But it's also this kind of feeling of the solidness of me, the reality of me, the unendingness of me, and this feeling of me, this attachment to the feeling of me, is just a very deep-rooted thing. And I think especially because it really hooks into our deepest fears, you know, fears of death, of not being. And it's really hard to avoid getting stuck in it. It's one of the ones that, you know, I think with the enchantment of the pleasant and the enchantment of the permanent, in a way we kind of know the truth, but we just don't want to see it. With the enchantment of the story of me, we may really not even know the truth, and it can really take practice to wake up to this one. And this enchantment of the story of me, I think it's so pervasive that it even invades our practice itself. It invades this process of transcendental dependent origination, or the way that we perceive it. And I know this has been a challenge for me, you know, in the sense that, you know, from hearing about it over this past months, that this transcendental dependent origination lays out a process through which we move from ignorance to awakening, to wisdom, to some kind of understanding. And, you know, going through these various different stages, starting our practice, getting more continuity of mindfulness and concentration, really connecting with our experience, feeling the excitement of that, joy, this kind of evening out to a tranquility and calm and steadiness, so we really can see things in a very clear way and maybe have some important insights that change our way of seeing things. And this is a beautiful description. And I think that even though in a way it sounds like something that's a very high bar, you know, many of us know that we do recognize at least parts of us it in our own practice experience and our own retreat experience. So it can be very inspiring and validating. But at the same time, the fact that there is a path and there is this sequence of things we can look at, I think it makes it so easy for us to get caught up in the idea of this as the ideal spiritual journey for us, and this thought that, you know, this is what ought to be happening to me, just like this. And when that happens, pretty soon, I know at least I, when this happens to me, I start, you know, looking at what's going on and kind of comparing what I'm noticing to this ideal, you know, maybe looking forward to the next thing or trying to make the next thing happen even. And then comparing what's actually happening to what I think should be happening, worrying that my progress isn't very good, you know, all this doubt arising, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, I'm not spiritual enough, I'm not dedicated enough, so on and so on and so on and so on. And all of these kinds of thoughts, all of that wanting and becoming that just, you know, goes right back into the cycle of samsara that we've been hoping to get out of with this transcendental dependent origination. And I don't know, maybe this feels and sounds kind of familiar to you too. So it doesn't just happen with the ordinary everyday things. It happens with our practice as well. And even, you know, when we're in a position, you know, in practice, in those times when we feel like we're in a very deep meditation and our sense of self is really thinned out, and we can still have this kind of feeling of someone or something observing and identify with that. And there can still be this very subtle sense of, you know, waiting for the next thing to happen, waiting for the next experience that we think will be better or deeper than whatever is happening now. Even on this very subtle level, the enchantment of the pleasant, the enchantment of the story of me, it really gets right in there. And I think if any of you have been following our founding teacher, Rodney Smith, with his, you know, book club that's he's been doing through IMS and his book on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, you know that even though the book is about the four foundations, a lot of what he's talking about is really this whole process of the way that we insert ourselves into our own spiritual practice until we finally see that the more we get in our own way, you know, the less we really understand. So how can we wake up and how can we free ourselves from these enchantments that are so insidious and so part of the way we are? Well, this process of transcendental dependent origination gives us some clues about this process, as Tim has pointed out this month. And he has really approach this, I think, in a really skillful way of emphasizing a couple of those points where some kind of change can really happen, where we recognize something or understand something and begin to do something different. And this process of waking up, it begins at some point, somewhere in the midst of all our confusion and delusion and enchantment, that we realize that something is wrong. And I don't know if we would say we realize we're suffering. We might not call it that, but we realize that somehow something is not going right. It could be really big problems or pain, or it could be just a vague feeling that something is missing in our lives. And if the circumstances are favorable at this point, we may have the faith and the presence of mind to, you know, stop and try something different. Stop and, you know, try the practice. And at this point, we may not really know exactly what is wrong, but we're willing to try some techniques that we've heard about that maybe will bring us to a point where we can get out of this quandary that we're in. So we have, you know, the willingness to actually begin to take a look and begin to try to see what's really going on. And gradually, maybe we settle down, we get quiet enough, and we actually begin to recognize our distortions and our enchantments. And then we wake up. And at this point, you know, we wake up and we know what is really going on. We see where we're caught and confused and what we're confused about. And maybe we still feel the effects of these enchantments because they're so deeply rooted and so deeply entrenched, but at least at this point, we aren't blind to them. We know them as enchantments, and we know them, you know, for the delusions that they are. And this process can be seen as something that operates over the course of our lifetime, you know, just the same way as we can see the cycle of dependent origination as something that operates through our physical birth to our physical death. And sometimes the process, you know, may play out in a retreat setting with intensive practice where we go through all these stages, as I mentioned before, until we reach a place where we really see clearly and have a deep recognition for ourselves of one or more of these three characteristics of dukkha, anicca, or anatta. And through our own experience, we understand how impermanent things are, how non-solid we are, how we create suffering for ourselves by clinging to what we really can't cling to. And when that happens, our view of things changes. And it's wonderful when it happens in that context, and I'd be the last one to discount it in any way. But at the same time, it's also true, as Tim pointed out last week, that this transcendent dependent origination isn't just about dramatic experiences that happen on retreat. Just as the same as dependent origination, transcendent dependent origination doesn't just happen, you know, as a lifetime thing over the cycle of practice, but over and over, moment by moment, every day. And we need that moment by moment, everyday aspect of it. We really do, because if all we had were the dramatic things that sometimes can happen, although they don't always happen on retreat, then we'd never really be able to integrate what we see in those dramatic moments with our everyday lives. They'd just be, you know, that dramatic moment that happened. So the day-to-day small awakenings are really, really important. We can consider first that point where we enter the process of transcendent dependent origination when we move from suffering to faith. And of course, this happens, you know, very significantly at the beginning of our practice, but we also recognize, especially after we've been at this for a while, that this movement from suffering to faith isn't something that just happens once. It happens over and over again. You know, it happens every time we realize that we've gotten caught up in a bad mood and our irritation and grouchiness, and we decide, oh, maybe I should stop for a minute and see what's going on here. Or every moment we get up in the morning and decide that, well, yeah, you know, I have a lot to do today, but maybe I will sit even if it's only for 5 minutes, because I know if I do, I'll start my day a little more grounded. So, you know, really that faith that got us started on the path keeps us returning over and over. And the same thing is true for disenchantment. Just as over and over we find the faith to move out of our suffering to a place of practice or to a return to mindfulness, we also recognize over and over that we've been caught up in some kind of enchantment, some kind of a delusion, some kind of a distortion. And we wake up. And usually, you know, there's some kind of pain or discomfort that alerts us that, oh, we're seeing things in some kind of a distorted way. And then we look and we see it. And I think there are many examples of when this happens, and you probably have noticed many of them over this last, you know, week. You know, and it happens when we get stuck in traffic and we find ourselves ranting and raging about, you know, how terrible, you know, it is in Seattle and what awful drivers there are and so on and so forth. And then we realize, oh man, I'm really making myself miserable here. And I'm, you know, assuming that unpleasant should never happen. Wait a minute here. It happens every time we stop and examine our physical or emotional pain to see what's really going on. And we recognize, you know, maybe this isn't what I thought it was. It happens when we question our stories about ourselves and find, well, you know, maybe what I've been thinking all this time isn't really true. It happens when we finally stop trying to fix things and improve things and make progress and become better. And we finally realize that when we're doing that, we're really just getting in the way of actually seeing what's going on, and we're willing to just show up and do nothing and let things unfold. As our founding teacher, Rodney Smith, might put it, it happens when our practice changes from one of progress and self-improvement to one of abiding, just being there. As Tim said last week, it happens when we release our ideas about things and let them just reveal themselves to us. When we're willing to simply be still and enter the mystery. And I'd like to end this talk with some words from the Samadhi Raja Sutta, I think a Mahayana Sutta, which speaks to that sense of entering the mystery. Know all things to be like this, a mirage, a cloud castle, a dream, an apparition, without essence, but with qualities that can be seen. Know all things to be like this, as the moon in a bright sky, in some clear lake reflected, though to that lake the moon has never moved. Know all things to be like this, as an echo that derives from music, sound, and weeping. Yet in that echo, there is no melody. Know all things to be like this, as a magician makes illusions of horses, oxen, carts, and other things. Nothing is as it appears. Well, thank you so much for your attention this evening. And now we have time for some group discussion. And as those of you who were here last week know, the practice and reflection for the week was about disenchantment. And I'll just read it for you as a reminder. This week, view the contents of your mind as an enchantment, a spell cast upon the moment so you see life through your conditioning and projections. What does it take to wake up from this spell? Explore the immediate and moment-by-moment release from this spell. How does this support ending the fundamental, persistent enchantment of self and others? So for the discussion period, I encourage you to share what you've learned over the past week from this exploration and experiment, the kinds of enchantments you've recognized in your mind, how you woke up, you know, the small and momentary awakenings that maybe contribute to a deeper understanding of these enchantments of pleasure, of permanence, and of the story of ourself. And since this is our final class on dependent origination and transcendental dependent origination, if you have time, I'd also invite you to share anything you might like to share about what you've learned over the past year of our study of this topic. So at this point, I'd like to invite anybody who, isn't able or just isn't in the place where a group discussion is the right thing for them right now to say goodbye, and glad to have you with us. And then I will form our groups. Well, welcome back, everybody. I see all these faces go appearing in this gallery. I see that you have all returned, and I hope you had a really productive and enjoyable discussion. And now there's time for some comments or questions, if anybody has anything that they would like to ask about or that they would like to share with the group. If you have a question, an easy way to do it is to put up the little blue hand that's in the participants box. Or you might be, I might see you if you just sort of wave your hand too. And then I'll let you know and you can unmute yourself. Oh, Suze? Can you unmute yourself? Okay.
Okay. Now,
okay.
Thanks.
Okay.
Something that just occurred to me when I was sharing in my small group is how we collectively seem to be having distorted views about COVID and the pandemic, and that somehow none of this should have ever happened. Mm. And so I don't, there is a natural unfolding of life, whether we like it or not. It's just, if it were going to be different, it would have been different, but I don't know if you want to speak to some of that about, the kind of the natural law of life unfolds as it will. And it just came to me when I was sharing that.
Yeah, Suze, that's a very good point. And I think it seems like this COVID has taught us so many things. I mean, if we ever needed a reminder that things can change and uncertainty is a fact of life, well, it's really given it to us. But I think what you're saying is true. In a certain way, it's very understandable that we feel like more could have been done to prevent this and to control it. And certainly I would not, disagree with that at all, but at the same time, just the fact of the way nature is and the likelihood that, these sorts of viruses and other things can evolve and occur and infect people, it's sort of like it's not unexpected that this could happen. So there is that sense of, I think with many things, when they're what we wouldn't want and what are painful and damaging, there's this sense of, instead of wasting so much time fighting the fact that it's happening by being angry and blaming people, see it clearly and do what can be done. If there's something that can be done to remedy the situation. I think that's maybe what I have, if anybody else has any thoughts or comments. Yes, Bob.
Yeah, when I was talking with Suze and Jean and Brooke, I was noting that I think the pandemic has made us all much more conscious that our mortality is out there, and we can't ignore it quite as blithely maybe as we did before. Did anybody see the cartoon that came out early on last, I think it was in the spring? It was a voice talking down to a group of people, and it was saying, all right, I'm going to send you all to your rooms now, and I want to think about what you've done. And we've all kind of been in our rooms thinking about what we've done.
Yeah. So that is true. And,
I certainly have been thinking about mortality a lot more, and just not in a morbid way. Can you be morbid about mortality? I don't. But yeah, just as you say, what not so much is it out there, but what then must we do, as they say in Zen? Since death is certain, but the time of death is uncertain, what then must we do? And I think in our group, I think the kind of the consensus was everybody felt that this year and the review of the 12 steps of dependent origination, as well as this sort of Zoom, has brought us together in ways that are rich and rewarding, especially for those of us who don't live in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And that it's enriched our practices. And Tim talked about faith. I was saying that I tend to think of it as trust rather than faith, because I think there's a demonstrable benefit to practice, and that's become clearer to me over this year, I think. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I can trust it. I also feel like I practice because otherwise I forget stuff. So it's easier to just practice every day, and then I keep getting reminded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Bob. That's really beautiful thoughts, and I think you probably speak for all of us, you know, saying that between the pandemic and Zoom and studying these teachings together, it's been difficult, but it's been enriching. So thank you. Let's see. Anybody else out there? Yeah. Oh, yes, Bob. Oh, wait. Did you have one short comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing, which that was sitting in the Thursday night group too, as the Capitol Hill group has been really interesting to address the issues around equity and diversity. Because that's such a, well, I don't know the other neighborhood groups there in Seattle, but that group is so diverse. And to hear people talking about real struggles and trying to put them in Buddhist context has been really also very enriching. Yeah,
that's great. Thank you. Now, Susan. Sorry. Oh,
thank you for that wonderful talk and this discussion. I had this interesting experience while you were sharing your talk, and you had that comment about our ability to recognize, you know, that we're in a suffering moment and to be able to do something about it. And you said, try the practice and that hit me. Try to practice. And that hit me like I'd never heard it before. And something loosened, and it's this idea of I've made something of the Dharma. You know, I really made something of the Dharma. and I saw, oh my gosh, this identity that I've forced on myself. And I don't want to know who I am. I want to abide in that mystery you're talking about. And I feel my body is like numbing right now, because I really feel like I touched something, and I'm putting something aside. I'm putting something aside and entering less ego. It's like, I don't know, it's a strange sense. It's like I have less self-consciousness. I have less watching myself to make sure I'm doing it, you know, in some way. And this showing up and just abiding, this really is lovely, and something that I'm experiencing. And the other thing I wanted to share is that, you know, spending the year with dependent origination and then the transcendental part is, I haven't held them equally, you know, because we haven't had 12 months.
No.
And so I really, and when you said, oh, you know, we come in and out the moments, we're up and down the continuum or the slide, however we want to put it, from disenchantment to suffering. And these are moment to moment becoming and letting go. And I'm like, oh yeah, we talked about that with dependent origination, and same as same with transcendence. Wow. I'm just really welcoming that in.
Yeah, thank you. So, Susan, you know, it's very interesting, because I think that's been one of my big learnings about this transcendental dependent origination, is because I've been so used to thinking about it as this template of practice, you know, and what happens over the long-term course of practice. But I think some of what Tim has said, and just looking at this, has really opened my eyes too to what a moment-to-moment thing this is, and how much those moment-to-moment recognitions of being caught and being under the spell and then waking up over and over and over and over again, how important it really is. So thank you so much for bringing that up. Right there with you. Thank you. Let's see. I think, do we have some announcements this week?
Might want to mention the Refuges and Precepts next week, next Monday night.
Yeah, I guess we don't have an announcement person, but yes, we do have Refuges and Precepts next Monday night, our annual ceremony. It'll be a little different online, but we'll see how it goes. And then, of course, since the LDLs are doing it, I have to put in a plug for our Buddhist Essentials class, the third Wednesday of the month. It will be on the Brahma Viharas.
And there are also two introductory classes coming up.
Yeah.
And if you know of anybody who might be interested, you know, encourage them to look into it.
Mm-hmm. And then Rodney's retreat at the last week of course, the month of January, the Saturday and Sunday. Yeah.
I was expecting somebody to say, oh, yes, I have announcements. So I didn't even prepare anything, but I think we've got it covered.
I think we have more. It's Alima's birthday.
Oh, yes. Wow.
Oh,
happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
How wonderful.
That's nice.
That's really nice. really nice. Happy birthday, Alima. So nice to see you too.
Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to share that with people.
Well, on that note, oh, Suze, did you have something?
I just wanted to say, at least in our group, everybody really has appreciated this year. And I want between, you know, there are a few of us LDLs and other folks who see Tewari and Tim. I want to make sure that they hear that, you know, that I think it's really been a fabulous year. And I'm so looking forward to the next year, 2021. Tim and Tewari are going to be doing 12 different topics of Dharma and daily life, but bringing what we've learned through this cycle to how to deal with issues and circumstances in our daily lives. And I think it's going to be really build on what we've done this year. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that should be great. We'll have a whole new and enriched perspective.
Yeah.
So I think on that note, it's probably getting time to wrap things up here. So to close, let's just sit together for a few moments. And in a way, offering metta and of sharing merit, I would like to offer an excerpt from a poem, To Bless the Space Between Us by William Donahue. And I think that this poem kind of offers the words that we maybe need for the closing of this year. This is the time to be slow, lie low to the wall until the bitter weather passes. Try as best you can not to let the wire brush of doubt scrape from your heart all sense of yourself in your hesitant light. If you remain generous, time will come good. And you will find your feet again on fresh pastures of promise, where the air will be kind and blushed with beginning. Thank you all so much for being here tonight, joining together. It's been a lovely evening, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak. And thank you for listening.